Hello and welcome to the Interviews podcast with me, your host, Elliot Stockdale. Today, legendary commentator Clive Tilser joins me as we discuss his career highlights as well as the current coronavirus crisis. Make sure to follow on Spotify, subscribe on YouTube notifications on, and get ready for more content coming your way. Hello, welcome everybody back to the podcast. Today with me, we have legendary commentator Clive Tilsley. It's an absolute honour to have you on the podcast. So thank you very much for taking the time out. Since, is it 1998, you've been a commentator for ITV?
I returned to ITV in 1996. I mean, in a nutshell, I had 18 months with Radio Trent, great to hear in East Midlands, twang again, Midook. And then moved on to local radio in Liverpool for the best part of 10 years, then regional television in Manchester, Granada Television, ITV. And then I had 4 years at the BBC, 92 to 96. 92 was the summer of change in British sports broadcasting when B-Sky B arrived on the scene. But in 1996, the late, great Brian Moore announced that he was going to do two more years and retire after the World Cup in 98. And so I went back to ITV kind of as his understudy. We had all the Champions League then, so we had plenty of content. And so I actually became ITV's senior football commentator, whatever you want to call it, in August 98.
And since then, there's been so many iconic moments that you've lended your voice to. And that's really what I want us to delve in and talk about. There's so many I could have picked out and so many that we could talk about, but I've picked out a few of my favourites and a few of what I've seen from online that have, you know, quite frankly, are iconic. So we'll start off with one of them, which is back in 2005, the Liverpool AC Milan Champions League final. Now, AC Milan, they stormed into a 3-0 lead, the Istanbul comeback. It's known so well, but when that Steven Gerrard goal went in, did you believe at any point that Liverpool were actually going to get back into it?
No. No, it was a pure broadcast device at that time. There was absolutely no inkling of it at all. I mean, I'm happy to go through the whatever incidents you choose one by one, but I'm a great believer that the football moments belong in their moment. And it's great that, you know, one of the silver linings to this great big black cloud, which is sitting over the world at the moment, is that people have had the opportunity to and the time to be a little nostalgic and look back on football matches that they loved and movies and music and so on and so forth. And, you know, it's great when your voice appears as part of the soundtrack to what a really big memories in the lives of people. You know, if you support a football team and that team's had any success at any level at all, it could be a promotion from the conference or, you know, from the National League. And you remember where you were, what your circumstances were, who you were going out with, everything about that, you know, surrounding that moment. And if you know, the commentator's voice is part of that moment, then it's a kind of special slushy feeling that we get in an era when we get more criticism than praise. So I think both 2005 and 1999, which I'm sure you're going to come on to, which are, you know, two Champions League finals that I was fortunate enough to call. I think in both cases there was an element of destiny, fate. To think back to 1999 and the Manchester United Bayern Munich game, which wasn't a very good game at all, but obviously boiled up into something extraordinary in the final 10 minutes, really, because Bayern hit the woodwork a couple of times before the two goals came along. All kinds of things happened, took a couple of substitutions in those last 10 minutes and so on. But apart from the actual pauses after the two Manchester United goals, which I'm quite proud of, because my broadcast mentor, Reg Guttridge, had taught me to use that time, give yourself thinking time when you have that luxury, which you don't really have in radio. Yeah. So apart from the two pauses, which I'm quite pleased with, probably the words that I said that night that you know, looking back, were Neymar on the trophy when Sheringham equalised, because there was an element of destiny. There was just something kind of mystical and magical had overtaken that Manchester United season from the moment that Schmeichel saved Bergkamp's penalty in the FA Cup semi-final, and then Giggs scored the goal, and then, you know, Roy Keane getting the yellow card that would rule him out of the final, and 2 minutes later heading the goal which put Manchester United back into the semi-final in Turin. So that gathering sense of, and so it is written, which is a wonderful thing about sport. Okay, you only get it with hindsight, or you only know it with hindsight, but you can kind of feel it in your bones a little bit in as it's happening. And for the first time that night, in the 4 or 5 minutes leading up to Sheringham's goal, Manchester United did look like scoring. The first time all night that they looked like scoring. So there was just a sense of something in the air. In Istanbul, there really wasn't. I mean, there had been a similar sense of destiny about Liverpool's season. You know, they finished fifth in the league that year. Mm. They scraped into the knockout phase, not just with Steven Gerrard's goal against Olympiakos, which is, you know, itself iconic in terms of commentary. You know, Andy Gray bursting in on Martin Tyler as the goal went in. But I mean, the fact that Cinema, Pongol and Mella scored the two goals before that. And then, you know, even the, was it the quarterfinal against Juve? You know, there was, there was a sense of occasion about all of that, which just led you to believe that. And of course, if you're thinking that, then so are Bayern Munich, so are Milan. Yeah. You know, if something happens in the game and you think these beggars are at it again, you know, at half time, it's 3-0 going on 33. And honestly, the third goal, which is scored just before half time, is a goal from the heavens. Hernan Crespo from an incredible pass by Kaká and a beautiful finish. And that's it. Go home, everybody. I mean, that spare. You listen to Jamie Carragher talking about it. Spare is the humiliation. You know, all this stuff about the stirring speech that Rafael Benitez gave in the dressing room. I mean, by his own admission, you can read the book. His English wasn't very good. By his own admission, he gave two team talks to the players, one which had 12 players on the board, one which had 10 players on the board. Finnan and Traore were having an argument about who was coming off. Harman had gone out to warm up and wasn't quite, he didn't know what the team was. So, you know, all of this came from nowhere. And the extraordinary thing about that final is, and I watched it all back because the two teams met again in 2 years later in the final, when Liverpool played far better and lost. When you watch it back, in the memory, they scored three times in 6 minutes, quite early in the second half, sort of between about 54 and 60 minutes. So from 3-0, it was 3-3. And you assumed that Liverpool had gone on from there. They didn't. Milan just continued to dominate the game as if the three goals hadn't happened. Dudek made a save from Shevchenko, which he's no idea to this day how he made. And then it's penalties and, you know, Shevchenko's got to go through all that again, which he'd been through 2 years earlier, Old Trafford in the final. I mean, when all of that is happening, all you can do as a commentator is, I'm not a great one for fairground rides, by the way. I don't have knuckles, let alone white knuckles. So, but you hang on. You're just hanging on for dear life. You're using the research that you've got, hopefully, to illustrate and, you know, editorialize, use it where it's relevant, only where it's relevant. You have got information that's there, which is, which is right. Let's say when Shevchenko's walking forward to take the penalty in exactly the same situation he'd been in the final 2 years earlier, then that's where those pearls come in. And you just go with it and you just keep trying to concentrate. My great mentor, Reg Gutteridge, just keep concentrating. Keep thinking what you're going to say next. Don't think out loud. Try your television. You've got the luxury of the pictures. You can pause and think how you're going to capture this moment, how you're going to serve that audience best, so that if this is ever shown again during a worldwide pandemic 15 years later, that your words will still be relevant to the situation. And that's you know, that's the challenge for us. You know, you're commentating yourself now, and that's the challenge. The vocabulary is there, the same vocabulary that, you know, Stephen King had to work with, that I don't know what music you like. I think Guy Garvey's a wonderful writer, Elbow. We've got the same damn words that they've got. We can use all of those words. We've just got to pick the right ones in the right order at the right time. And that's our job. Finish.
Yeah. I mean, you've hit the nail on the head there, completely spot on. And there's so many times throughout the years where certain commentators have used certain words and it's just stuck there, and it's just worked perfectly. But moving on from that Champions League final and the 99 one, let's just have a quick look at that Drogba Bayern Munich one. Again, an amazing end to the game. But my main question is, again, really to do with the atmosphere at the Allianz, because it was one of those peculiar situations where Bayern Munich were the home team. They were at their home stadium. And Chelsea had just a horrendous season. You mentioned earlier with Liverpool, they finished fifth. Chelsea, no idea what happened there. They sacked the manager, Roberto Di Matteo took charge, and then they somehow managed to get to a Champions League final, completely against the odds. 90th minute, Drogba's there, win it on penalties. I can't even imagine what the stadium felt like at the time.
Yeah, I mean, the big question before that game, and you know, we've seen it in home games. The Liverpool Arsenal. I was at the Liverpool Arsenal title decider in '89, working for local radio in Liverpool then. And you feel as if home advantage is a huge plus, but if things start to turn, then you want to be anywhere but your own stadium. You just want to be a million miles away from here, and you're feeling all the anxiety. And from your fans, I mean, pressure is an overused word in all sport, in life. But what is it? And pressure is basically expectation, people's expectations of you and your own expectations of yourself. And Bayern Munich hadn't won. I don't think they'd won a trophy the previous season. They certainly hadn't won the Europe. They'd lost a couple of European Cup finals, lost to Villa. And so, it was that. I mean, I remember being a part, obviously, the Champions League coverage with Manchester United in their sort of halcyon years. That there was a final at Old Trafford in 2003. There was a final in Glasgow, and these became massive pressures for Ferguson and Manchester United. The chance to play a final, either in your hometown or in your home ground, and I think that as the night wore on, Bayern had their chances, a penalty, didn't take them. That's when it starts to close in on you, and here you are, ticking into the final minute of the biggest game of your lives. They can't imagine playing anything other than a Champions League final on your own ground.
Yeah,
and if Drogba has half a chance in the air. It's that terrible foreboding moment when your team's winning 1-0 and the opposition get a free kick on the edge of your penalty area with a minute. You kind of know it's going in, or you tell yourself as a football fan, you know, we are kind of sort of glass half empty people because we've been there before. We know this is going to happen. You know, you love your football team like you love your children. You won't hear a word against them, but you kind of know them, and you know that from time to time they're going to let you down, and they're probably going to do it right now. And it was a fabulous header, by the way, a wonderful header by a wonderful striker, I think the best striker of the Premier League era. And from that point onwards, it's tough for Bayern Munich. They're treading water, you know. They're telling their legs, these wonderfully athletic men, telling their legs what to do, and their legs want to do something. Now they don't want to be there. They want to be somewhere else. And it closes in on you. And when it goes to penalty shootout, listen, penalty shootouts are easy to read after they're over. You do feel as if the favouritism has kind of swung with that moment, simply because it's at that moment that it dawns on Bayern that they might be about to blow the biggest chance of their lives.
You spoke then about Bayern Munich and the fact they were the home team and dealing with that expectation of the fans and, you know, the overused word of pressure. But if we're being honest, when it comes down to England, there is so much expectation on them to succeed and to do well. And every generation that we've had is just the golden generation. And every time they just seem to fail. So over the years that you've been commentating England, I'm going to hazard a guess that the 2018 World Cup is the best and probably the most exciting you've actually seen England do.
Well, you've got to remember about the England national football team is that it is the most popular football team in our country. Mm. I mean, television viewing figures don't tell you everything, but watching television is something of a democracy. You can choose whether or not to do it. And the football team that gets the biggest viewing figures in this country is not Manchester United or Liverpool, it's England. And so for the supporters of a lot of clubs around the country, that this is their Champions League, watching their national team play. And of course, if England are playing in a tournament, it then transcends football. It becomes the Strictly final or a royal wedding. It becomes a national event. It's Olympic proportions. Mm. And so you talk about pressure and expectation. You know, I did, you know, what is pressure? It's expectation. Then that shirt does weigh very heavily on the shoulders of a player. And particularly their own expectations when you have got good players. I mean, there have been some very, very, very good, great is an overused word in football, but certainly half a dozen of them bordering on greatness that have played for England in the modern era. And so you know that there's an opportunity. You know that you do have really the raw material to take on certainly most teams in the world. And you've got this fantastic following. I mean, whenever you're fortunate enough to go to a major tournament, okay, there's some trouble comes with an England following, but there's also huge numbers and huge vocal support, huge pride. You see the flags all around an England stadium. They don't say Manchester United or Liverpool or Chelsea or Arsenal. They say Bolsover, or they say, you know, Matlock or whatever. That's where England fans come from. They support a team in the National League, or they support a team in League One or whatever. That's where England supporters come from. And so, yeah, there is a huge amount of expectation and therefore a huge amount of pressure. And of course, when it starts to become a self-fulfilling prophecy, you know, when you don't have the record of success that, for instance, a German side have or a Spanish team built, whether becomes the expectation is different then, but where you actually get to a quarter final and there is a voice in the back of your head saying, well, this is about as good as we are. We're not going to go any further than this. Something's going to happen here. You know, Ronaldinho is going to float one in from nowhere, or something's going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, that, and a lot of the players that you're talking about, the Gerrards and Lampards and Beckhams, they were children during, you know, the time when Gascoigne nearly turned in that cross when, you know, the penalties were missed and so on and so forth. So it's and you've got to somehow break the cycle, break the curse. And I'm totally biased with Gareth Southgate. Gareth Southgate was at our wedding. So I've got my mate in charge of the England team. Who do I support? I support England. But he's got it. Everything you see from a distance is Gareth. That is him. That's not a front. That's not a smokescreen. That's not some PR creation. That is him. Yeah. Bright, smart, thorough, earnest, strong opinions. You know, don't think that the nice guy hasn't got an opinion. I'm fortunate enough to have his confidence, so we talk off the record. If you don't fancy a player, wow. You think Roy Keane can strip somebody down. I mean, Gareth can do that in private, but again, bright enough not to put himself out there, protect the players, got the trust of the players. No real egos in that squad, no megastar, no divisions. I mean, don't worry about the Gomez-Sterling thing. That was just personal pride coming on the back of a very big football match, and that's all that was. That's the Liverpool-Man City is a growing rivalry in our game. But that those two are cool. They're fine. Everything's good about England. And maybe the expectations aren't quite as high. But it would have been interesting this summer. Hopefully will be interesting next summer because one or two bright young things will be a year older. But yeah, again, coming back to Bayern Munich in 2012, it's a definite advantage for England going into the tournament. No doubt about that. Play the group games at Wembley with the possibility of a semi-final at Wembley is a definite advantage. But if it starts to go wrong in the opening game, and Gareth will be the first to tell you that the difference between Euro 16 and the World Cup, there are lots of differences. And England, and Roy is a huge friend, by the way, and a really, really good man and manager. But Gareth learned from that. But the big difference really is in England's opening game at those Euros, we were better than Russia. We were 1-0 up. We were playing well. And they scored the most bizarre equalising goal in the last minute. A guy called one of the Berezovsky twins scored a goal. He'll never score again if he lives to be 150. And in the first game of the World Cup, we were drawing against a team that we were expected to beat. And we scored a goal in the last minute to win it. And we were playing the dog and duck in the next game. You know, you and I could have played centre-back against them and Panama and we'd have been all right. So suddenly you've qualified, no matter what happens against Belgium there, and then you're on, you know, and then you win a penalty shootout. If we lose that penalty shootout, what's the nation think of Gareth Southgate right now?
Yeah,
probably. He might not even be in the job, strangely. He might not even really be. I think I've known personally probably 10 England managers, and he is the best suited man that I know for the job. But it's a different job from any other, and it's a different team from any other.
Quite frankly, when Gareth Southgate was appointed, I was really, really happy, delighted with that appointment. I quite like Roy Hodgson as a manager. I wasn't too happy with how he was doing as England manager, but again, it's such a difficult job. But I'll be perfectly honest, Gareth Southgate gave me the happiest summer of my life. And while it wasn't the most difficult teams that England were playing against, and that's always been the argument, you know, the 2018 World Cup, it wasn't as good as people thought because of the teams we played. I will be ever grateful for that summer that we had. It was just absolutely incredible. And it turned everything I ever knew of England on its head because I'd experienced a 2010 World Cup, the 2014 World Cup, and both of them just ended in tears. This one did as well, but it was a semi-final. And, you know, I would have bitten your hand off for a quarter-final, never mind a semi, and we got it to extra time. So it was absolutely fantastic. And compared to what happened against Iceland at the Euros, absolute dreamland.
That was the most difficult game I've ever commentated on for all kinds of reasons. Roy's really close, Gary Neville, very close friend. I was given an insight. I mean, you know, without telling tales out of school, Gareth looks after me in terms of information and briefings, but Roy and Gary probably even more so. And, you know, England played pretty well at that tournament. I know exactly... You know, because obviously I've spoken to the two of them and they've told me things that they would never say publicly about what happened in that game. But it is one of the great mysteries. I mean, we were supposed to be in the wrong side of the draw, but to get Iceland and then a one goal start, which is the only thing you can possibly ask for against Iceland. I mean, if Iceland can keep it 0-0 for 60 minutes, then you've got... You know, you've got worries because of the way they defend. But if you're given a penalty, and it was, I wouldn't say it was a dodgy penalty, but it was a soft penalty in that time. And I mean, you know, you can read between the lines of this, but just to give you an insight into the fact that, you know, these managers, they take the responsibility because they feel as if that's, you know, that's what the leader should do. And they take the blame because that's what, that's where we apportion it. They don't kick a football, but we give them the blame. We sometimes give them the praise. But they are dealing with human beings. And Iceland's throws were 50% of the threat. And England worked on two different sessions on defending Iceland throws. And if I tell you that the two people that let them down on the first throw-in that Iceland had were the most experienced international and the person who had played best for England up to that point in the... And they just had, literally, one had to get touch tight with somebody and the other one had to follow a runner. And they there was no surprise about it. The runner wasn't a surprise runner. The runner was exactly who they expected it to be. And the guy who flicked it on was given a full yard of space, 4 meter of space, and the runner was untracked. And I mean, can you imagine? I mean, what would be the equivalent? It'd be like your head of department preparing you for an exam and saying, do you know what? I think the first question will be this. And we're going to do 2 full days on that. Okay. And blow me down. You turn the page over in the exam paper. And actually the second question, because the first question was dead easy because you get the lead. And the second question is the one that he briefed you for. And you answer it completely wrongly. Whose fault is it?
it's true.
It's the lecturers.
Yeah, nail on the head there.
And now, listen, they still had 85 minutes to do something about it. But nonetheless, that moment changed the game. Once Iceland equalised, it was you were back where you started. So anyway, that was tough. I had 2 minutes from the end. I had to say the fateful words from Roy Hodgson's position as England manager would be untenable. And this is somebody that my wife and I have been out for dinner with him and his wife on several occasions. So that's a part of the job that people don't often think about.
No, you're going to make friends in the industry. You're going to get to know people. And I've had tales from one of my lecturers, Pete Lancel. He's told me many tales about Martin O'Neill. And last year, when Forest weren't doing great, it was quite interesting between me and Pete, because Pete could see the situation at Forest with Martin O'Neill, but he could also see where I was coming from. But he knows Martin well. They're good friends and they meet up regularly. But it's the nature of the game. It's going to happen from time to time. I'm going to go a bit left field with one of my penultimate questions here. And it wasn't even in the notes that I sent you, so apologies for springing this on you. But how did your deal with EA Sports come about when you were asked to come on board to commentate for the FIFA games?
I think they must have bought some Champions League rights. They came to me. I wasn't touting for it. Motti was the FIFA commentator of the day. Mm. I was aware of FIFA, obviously, as a father. So I had an understanding of the game. And therefore, when I was approached, I came from a different direction than anybody they'd worked with before, because I had a knowledge of the product. And so I came with some ideas. FIFA is made in Vancouver. It's made from EA's Canadian studios. And the FIFA script that I inherited had goaltenders and goal miners in it. And worse still, it had shots bursting the onion bag, and which is all comedic the first time you hear it. But if you play FIFA solidly for 3 hours and you hear it 105 times, it starts to lose its charm. And, yeah. You know, my argument to the developers, I actually went over and gave a couple of seminars in Vancouver to the game programmers. And actually, my big message was your problem isn't the commentary really so much as the gameplay, because at the time Pro Evo was better and they needed to up the game. They had all the licenses, they had all the teams and the players, but the gameplay wasn't great. And that was what was holding them back, really, more than the audio track. But I started to preach to them as I preached to broadcast students, which is that, you know, television is a visual medium. In the commentary is only the soundtrack. The soundtrack to the movie is important, but you don't go to the cinema to see the soundtrack. You go to the cinema to see the movie. And so the soundtrack to FIFA needed to be less obtrusive. It needed to be less curious. It needed to be more credible, more understated, more authentic. And so I rewrote the entire FIFA script and took out all the onion bags and just made it sound more like a football commentary, really. And so yeah, my association with the game grew from there, because I had a stake really in how it sounded. I became aware that, probably more aware than Motti had been, that this was as big in my career as anything that I was doing with ITV, the reach of this game and your association with it. My wife and I honeymooned in the Middle East, and one of the wonderful places that we visited in Jordan was a wadi out in the desert where you go and spend a night under the stars. And we were driven out to the canvas. it was pretty much Glastonbury. It was glamping, really. It was there was a loo there and everything. We were driven out by a Bedouin in a Land Rover, and he had his two sons with him, who were probably, I don't know, 8 and 10, something like that. And I was talking away to him, and they were wide-eyed, and one of them said something to him in the native language, you know what's coming here. And he had the English, and he said, are you football? And I said, yeah, FIFA? And I said, yeah, and I turned to the boys, and I started to commentate, and they pointed at me as if I just landed from Mars. And I was the voice on their FIFA. I was the voice on their FIFA in Jordan, in a Bedouin community. Now, ITV gets to a lot of places, don't get to a Bedouin community in Jordan. So FIFA's an extraordinary product, and the gameplay is great now. I don't do it anymore. I made the mistake of recording too much material for them, really, so that they had me shouting every name under the sun and every team under the sun. And I suppose when ITV started to lose some rights, then, I mean, they did, Martin Tyler and Alan Smith had already started to do it. Andy Townsend and I were the other team, and they only needed one commentary team, so we got ditched, which I didn't mind too much, because it was hard work. It was hard work writing scripts and stuff, and I'd done it for a few years. So, but yeah, that was the FIFA story.
I've always wondered how it all goes about. So, honestly, thank you very much for telling me about that. Honestly, fascinating, because without FIFA, I wouldn't even like football. I liked FIFA before I liked football. And then it just went from one thing to another.
Well, football's got to be careful. I mean, we've got guys in their 20s, and football does take its public for granted. Almost, and it'll be interesting to see just, you know, how we come back to football. There's a great appetite for football at the moment, but, you know, when you go a long time without something, and we're going to go a bit longer yet without actually going to football matches, or seeing football matches as we know them, then if you're not careful, if you've taken your audience for granted, you can start to lose them. And I would say that certainly in their teens, our guys would be as involved in a game of FIFA they were playing as they would be watching proper live football. And if some draconian parent, I walked into their room and said, right, you've got to lose one of them. Yeah, I either stop watching that Spanish league game, or I'm going to take your FIFA off you. I know which it would have been.
Yeah,
they'd have kept the FIFA.
But you set that up perfectly there, because I'm wanting to talk about what is going on at the minute. It's so unavoidable, and while I think everyone's really just getting sick and tired of what's going on, isolation, this, that, and the other, it is pretty much the only talking point to really discuss into. So just before this, actually, some news came out that it looks set really in Germany for the Bundesliga to resume in 10 days time. So around a fortnight, it is set to resume. The government are going to announce tomorrow. So my question to you is, can you, one, expect this to happen in England anytime soon? And two, do you think it should be happening in England anytime soon?
Well, as I say, a mastermind pass. I don't know. It's not. I haven't really got involved in the debate, because I found a lot of the debate a bit tiresome and almost disrespectful to the nature of the crisis that we're facing. You know, I think Jurgen Klopp's phrase that football's the most important of the unimportant things has nailed it for me. I understand that the administrators, I mean, it is an industry with a lot of employees, and not all of those employees are on 400 grand a week. So there is a duty of care and a responsibility to try to get the industry moving again, just as there is in any business. I think the government probably recognise that there is a morale thing here, and that if something's going on to divert people's attention, then everything else might become a little bit easier. So I think football will be given every encouragement and every help. Without being too serious or too grim about this, I just feel that the nature of the pandemic has been so life-changing for everybody in the world. Mm-hmm. And it's difficult to believe that anything or anybody will come out the same at the other end, whatever the other end is. And you kind of hope that anything and everybody will come out a little different, probably with a slightly better perspective, a slightly wider responsibility, kinder to each other, more appreciative of each other. And we might even be slightly better people for this terrible experience, those of us that survive it. I have to say, in the reporting of the talks that I've heard surrounding the Premier League, I've seen absolutely none of that in the last 3 or 4 days. What I've seen is depressing self-interest rearing its ugly head again, straight away. Now, I'm not going to get too Methodist or sanctimonious about this, because football is all about self-interest. The joy, part of the joy of football is the jeopardy, the winning and the losing, the rivalry, the tribal loyalty that you feel to your football club. And so when the MD of Brighton is saying that, listen, we don't want to get relegated, full stop, any of us down here at the bottom, we just want to scrap relegation. And when pressed as to whether that's being a bit self-serving, he said, yeah, dead right we are. At least I admire his honesty, and I'm sure every Brighton fan's with him, because that's how we feel. It's us against the world, football. That's how it's couched. That's how it works. We tend not to have a favourite second team. You know, it's our team. It's our team or anybody but. It's that whole kind of, that's what keeps me in a business. That's the business that you're hoping to move into. That passion that unbalances people. Very reasonable, rational people behave totally different during the 90 minutes that their football team is playing. And that engagement is what keeps me in an occupation. That's why televised football is so important in people's lives. We mustn't forget that we don't turn on to watch the Premier League or the Champions League. I mean, again, it's all this sort of, he is a record goal scorer in the Premier League. Well, wait a minute, what about the 100 years before that? You know, they were all still trying to score goals when it was just the first division, you know. Those goals counted every bit as much. And so all this branding that we've invented, and the very fact that television is so heavily involved in the talks at the moment, shows, the role that we play in how all of this, we are the stakeholders, we are the people who pay the players' wages. So it is all a little bit Orwellian. And we've got to remember somehow, if somebody gave me a soapbox to speak to the world for 2 minutes about football, I would be saying something like, it's actually the game we love, it's the kicking the football around. It doesn't matter how much the guy's getting paid. It doesn't matter what actually they're playing for, whether it's the Champions League or the European Cup or the UEFA Cup or the Inter. You can rebrand it all you like, but actually we're just trying to be the best football team in Europe by playing the best football in it. But it's the football that matters. And I mean, honestly, every other business in the country certainly has got to pick up where it left off when everything eases. Why wouldn't football have to pick up exactly where it left? Finish the season. Just finish the season. However you've got to finish the season. People talking about the integrity of the competition is compromised if all the games are played in neutral grounds. Well, the integrity of the competition is compromised if you just say, well, that's it now, and no, there's no promotion, no relegation. And those 30-odd games that every team's played, that you and our friends have all paid money to go and watch, well, do they get their money back because those matches didn't matter? No, you've got to see this through. And you know, Liverpool don't want to be champions with an asterisk next to the name. They want to play the 38 games and have more points than anybody. They've been waiting 30 years for this. Barrow have been waiting however many years to get back into the Football League. And you can't just cut it off just because there might be some complications over contracts or, you know, transfer windows or some sort of calendar for 12 months hence. We'll worry about 12 months hence when it comes. You know, if next season's got to be 19 games, then fine, then that's fine. But let's finish this season firstly somehow. Neutral grounds, our back garden, wherever you want to finish it. Let's have these football teams playing these games against each other, finishing it off. And there's your integrity. That's the only integrity, because this is a competitive sport, and winning and losing is what determines people's jobs and people and the happiness and misery of the fans. And so that has got to be an element in it. It's got to be an element in it. And I just hope that those who are campaigning against that at the moment for their own self-interest can somehow see that or be outvoted, and we can get this thing done.
Yeah, I won't completely air my thoughts on it right now. I'll probably say that for another time, but I'm pretty much the same as you. I want the season to be finished, even if that's in 4 or 5 months' time. I've seen, I think it was Wayne Rooney, of all people, to come out a few weeks ago and say, let's do this, because that means it will fall in line with the Qatar World Cup, which is going to be a Winter World Cup. So make the seasons fall in line with that. And that's something that I think that the, you know, UEFA, FIFA, FA, whoever's involved with it needs to look at. But that is everything now. So thank you very, very much for joining me on here. You know, just a huge thanks again. Absolute pleasure and an honour to have you on. So if you have enjoyed this, make sure to subscribe, notifications, like, follow on Spotify, because hopefully we'll have more top-class guests like this. But once more, thank you very, very much, Clive.
Pleasure. Okay, take care.